Good afternoon. It's Thursday, August 4th, 2022, and time to read from today's Sioux City Journal. I'm Sandy Barron. I'm a volunteer and pleased to be able to bring you the news today. Here's a look at what we'll be reading. First, we'll read stories of local interest. Next, we'll turn to the opinion page, and at half past the hour, we'll read the obituaries. We'll conclude with sports and feature stories as time allows. First, let's take a look at the weather. Today, mostly sunny, winds out of the southeast, 6 to 12 miles per hour, and a high of 92. Tonight, clear to partly cloudy, winds out of the south-southeast, 6 to 12 miles per hour, and a low of 64. Friday, we'll have sunshine, winds subsiding, and it'll be very hot, with a high of 96 and a low of 73. Saturday, we'll have mostly cloudy and very warm with a high of 92 and a low of 68. Sunday will be not as warm, a stray morning thunderstorm with a high of 80 and a low of 61. And Monday will remain in the 80s with a high of 86 and a low of 64. The sun rose this morning at 6:21 a.m. and will set tonight at 8:42. Tomorrow, the sun will rise at 6:22 a.m. and set at 8:41 p.m. Next, here's the mini editorial. Today's mini editorial comes to us from William F. Burroughs of Sioux City. He writes, "The writer of the 8:122 mini editorial proved that, quote, old soldiers never die, they just fade away. He makes no mention of the hundreds of children shot with an AR-15. Perhaps he should join Senator Thune in South Dakota to pick off some prairie dogs one at a time." And again, this mini came to us from William F. Burroughs of Sioux City. The first headline on the front page reads, "Council discusses new fencing, new water tank." And this comes to us from Dolly A. Butts of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. "The Sioux City Council discussed fencing in the new Grandview Park water tank with either chain link or wrought iron fencing during a retreat meeting Wednesday at the Siouxland Expo Center. Sioux City Utilities Director Brad Putz told the council the tank structure itself is nearly complete. They painted, I believe, the second coat yesterday, or they're on the second coat. But after the painting is done, they're done and gone," he said. "The water lines are within feet of the tank, ready to be connected. And after that, it's just a matter of a little bit of beautification and getting a retaining wall up and getting everything in place. Since the city's investment is ready, roughly $7.5 million with the new tank alone, Putz requested feedback on installing a fence. He said all of the city's other water assets are protected by fencing. Two previous tanks in the park were built in the 1890s. The south tank was taken out of commission in 1993 after bulges were discovered in the structure. Throughout the years, prominent artists such as Paul Chelsted and Mark Cochin have painted images onto the concrete walls. Music fans who were inspired by the activity, by the annual Saturday in the Park Festival, which uses the park as its venue, also left anonymous art. We've had discussions about painting on the tank. I'm perfectly fine with that. I think it should be controlled," Putz said. "I think we should consider very strongly the possibility of putting a fence around that tank. It shouldn't affect any park activities." Mayor Bob Scott asked Putz about going with chain-link fencing rather than wrought iron, which is the type of fencing that surrounds the city water treatment plant, wastewater treatment plant. "It's not even attractive around your sewer plant, I'm sorry," Scott said. "You pay five times as much for wrought iron?" Councilman Alex Waters said he expects there will be some pushback from residents about the fencing. "A lot of the graffiti or murals that were on that previous tank were celebrated," he said. There were people that were doing their senior pictures there. City Manager Bob Padmore stressed that city staff is okay with professional artists painting murals on the new tank. What we're not okay with is people who then take it upon themselves, if they see a nice new painted water tower, to just start doing things on their own and declare it art, he said. The council also reviewed a draft of the city's 2022-2026 strategic plan, and talked about drilling a new well. Finance Director Teresa Fitch gave council members a status update on the projects funded with American Rescue Plan Act dollars. The city has $40.6 million in ARPA funding to spend on water, sewer, and broadband projects, as well as public health and negative economic impacts. The city has until December 31st, 2024 to allocate the funds and an additional 2 years to spend them. Currently, $1.8 million is slated to go toward infrastructure for an affordable housing development, but the city hasn't identified a site for the development. A site near West Middle School and a site in Woodbury Heights are being examined. We want to create affordable housing, but affordable housing doesn't mean low-income housing. It means starter homes for people that don't meet guidelines for low-income on a starter house, Padmore said. The city's initial plan was to advocate $5 million in ARPA funding to outer drive water pressure and storage. Fitch said the matter will be brought back to the council with a request to reduce the amount to $4 million so $1 million can be moved to the well replacement program. Fitch said he thinks it will be very difficult to get the funding for the water pressure and the storage project under contract before the ARPA deadline. The other front page story is accompanied by a picture showing workers finishing parts of the stage in the multi-purpose auditorium at the new Hunt Elementary School building. Almost ready. This story comes to us from Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. Hunt Elementary School staff are working quickly to prepare for the first day of school in their new building. The Midtown Neighborhood School, just north of 19th Street, between Jackson and Nebraska Streets, has been under construction for 2 years and will welcome its first students August 23rd. The district took possession of the building June 1, and teachers were welcomed July 25th. The summer has been spent putting the finishing touches throughout the building and receiving furniture deliveries while teachers take time to set up their new spaces. The L-shaped building will be about three times larger than the previous Hunt, which once stood near the construction site. The old school, built in 1906, was demolished in June 2019. Construction started September of 2020. Hunt Elementary Principal Cammie Barker said there are teachers who have been with Hunt for over 20 years, and it is exciting for them to be in a new building. Our students and families and staff deserve this, Barker said. Since Hunt was officially closed in 2019, the school's students attended classes in the former Crescent Park Elementary School at 114 West 27th Street. When entering the new school, there are seven words chosen by the staff on what Hunt means to them. The words are believe, explore, dream, create, dance, imagine, and inspire. Continuing into the commons area, the large Hunt letters carved into the sandstone from the original school building have been incorporated into the wall. This has been done in multiple new school constructions in Sioux City to remember the original buildings and provide a nostalgia feel. Other terracotta decorations that were part of the original school are framed and displayed throughout the building. A majority of the school is on one floor, but a lower level features additional classrooms. Because the design of the building, each classroom boasts large windows. Because Hunt is named the A+ for Arts and Music School, there is a performing arts stage in the gymnasium that also features terracotta aspects that were part of the original Hunt building. Barker said it is one of her favorite parts of the school. Barker said, the teachers incorporate the arts in lessons every day, and the arts are utilized to teach the standard. The school theme was known before the design process, so specific rooms were designed to cater to it. The Black Box Theater is a space for students to do performances, as well as a space for clubs such as dance, theater, piano, and vocal. Another new feature of the building is a gallery room where students will be able to showcase artwork and parents will get to view different projects. One of the visitors' favorite parts in the new Hunt building is a large windowed stairwell that looks onto Jackson Street. There are three outdoor playgrounds, each geared to a specific grade level, the same as other recent elementary schools built in the district. As with other new schools, the new Hunt will have one main entrance with a security system during school hours to keep pupils safe. Visitors will be directed solely to the principal's office area. Barker wants the school to be a safe space for students, both physically and emotionally. Tim Paul, the district's director of operations and maintenance, said construction has gone smoothly with only a few bumps due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Because the project started before the pandemic, many items were able to be ordered before there were shortages. The entire school is geothermal, a more efficient heating and cooling system. It is the only school in the district with a chilled beam system to provide an even and moderate temperature throughout the building. Barker previously said it is amazing to see the building now compared to when she saw the architect designs. She said more than 90% of the students walked to the original school. Originally, there was only one bus that was intended for students living in shelters. The total cost of the project is estimated at $22 million. The project is being financed by the district's share of a 1% sales tax the state designates for new and expanded schools and other physical improvements. The school was named for Dr. Andrew Hunt, a physician and dentist, who was also the first president of the Sioux City School Board. The previous school was easily the district's oldest. The oldest remaining school building in Sioux City is now Sunnyside Elementary, which dates to 1957. Public hearing set for wind ordinance change. This comes to us from Caitlin Yamada of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. Three public hearings have been set to discuss changes to Woodbury County's commercial wind farm setback distances. The hearings will take place at the next three Board of Supervisors meetings, August 8th, 16th, and 23rd. The hearings will give the public an opportunity to voice their opinions on the setbacks, as well as give supervisors an opportunity to review the staff's draft. The Woodbury County Board of Supervisors previously voted to move forward in amending a wind energy ordinance, increasing the distance between wind turbines and the county residents from the current 1,250 feet. Supervisor Rocky DeWitt proposed a 2,500-foot increase, stating all of the supervisors have received numerous comments from citizens wanting the increase. DeWitt said he had had zero people contact him in favor of keeping the current setback distances. The board voted 3-2 to move forward amending the ordinance to a 2,500-foot setback. The ordinance was initially approved in July 2021, creating rules for commercial wind farms such as setback distances from public and private property and safety rules for secondary roads. Prior to the creation of this ordinance, the county had a zoning ordinance that allowed wind energy in agricultural preservation and general industrial zones. The ordinance, approved in 2021, only affected commercial wind energy development. Chair Keith Radig said he is not supportive of amending the ordinance because it would all but eliminate wind in Woodbury County. "I don't think that is within our job description," he said. "The full setback distances in the ordinance are 110% of total height from adjacent property lines, unoccupied residences, confinement feeding operation building, public road right-of-way, and public conservation areas, 1,250 feet from occupied residences, 600 feet from cemetery or city limits, and 110% of total height from adjacent property lines, unoccupied non-residential buildings, and confinement feeding operations building." Evan's intoxication is the question for jury. This comes to us from Nick Heitrick of the Sioux City Journal from Sioux City. "Whether Dwight Evans shot Martez Harrison is not the question jurors will decide during their deliberations. On more than one occasion, during 3 days of witness testimony and evidence, and again Wednesday during closing arguments, Evan's attorneys said he's the shooter. Their defense, he was intoxicated at the time he pulled the trigger of the revolver that fired the two shots that killed Harrison, and the shooting was justified because Evans thought he might be in danger as his friend Lawrence Kennedy fought with Harrison outside Uncle Dave's bar in the early morning hours of May 1st, 2021. Jurors received the case at 4:30 p.m. and spent 30 minutes deliberating before leaving for the night. They will return at 9 a.m. Thursday to resume their discussions. Throughout the trial, jurors saw video of Evans taken at different times that night and heard his mother describe him as so wasted when his friends brought him home hours before the shooting that he could not hold his head up or walk without assistance. Police officers who apprehended Evans 3 hours after the shooting said they saw no indications he was intoxicated, and he carried on a conversation with one of them in a police car after his arrest. He clearly was able to talk to the officer. "There are no signs of intoxication," First Assistant Woodbury County Attorney Mark Campbell said. Campbell told jurors, "The law says that even if a defendant is under the influence when committing a crime, he is responsible for his actions unless he's unable to form the specific intent to act." When he left his house with Kennedy that night, Campbell said, "Evans had the intent to shoot and kill Harrison as revenge for Harrison hitting a friend's girlfriend previously. He brought along a loaded gun, and during the fight outside the bar, security footage showed him approach the scuffle, aim the gun, and fire shots into Harrison's left flank and upper abdomen. He fled immediately after the shooting. The defendant had enough presence of mind to know he needed to get out of there," Campbell said. "He knew what he did was wrong." Other videos shown during the trial tell a different story, public defender Michael Adams said. He showed footage taken more than 4 hours after the shooting in a police interrogation room in which officers twice entered and had a difficult time waking Evans, who then stumbled and swayed when they made him stand to have his picture taken and his hands swabbed. Adams encouraged jurors to watch the videos again and review photos of Evans taken during that night. "Decide for yourself if he looks intoxicated," Adams said. Surveillance footage of the fight and shooting had no audio, Adams said, so it's not known what kind of danger Evans perceived, what Harrison might have said when he stepped outside the bar to confront Kennedy, who had just punched Harrison's fiancée in the face. but during the fight, Evans can be seen standing to one side, watching rather than participating. Dwight stood there because he was stoned out of his head. He wasn't looking for anyone. He might have been looking for a place to sit down and go to sleep, Adams said. Campbell said Evans was standing in the shadows, waiting for Kennedy to draw Harrison out into the street so he could shoot him. If Evans felt he was in danger, leaving the scene before firing the gun was a more reasonable alternative. The defendant in no way in this case was justified in what he did, Campbell said. Harrison, 22, died later at a Sioux City hospital. Evans, 18, of Sioux City, is also charged with going armed with intent. We turn now to the opinion page and read another view from the Dallas Morning News, headlined, Social Media Must Be Held Accountable. And again, this is another view editorial from the Dallas Morning News. We are glad to see the consequences for the devastating lies that conspiracist Alex Jones promoted about the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre begin to materialize last week in an Austin, Texas courtroom. But as much as Jones is the culprit for the defamation campaign that painted the families who lost children as liars and actors, and that caused at least one family to move a dozen times after being doxxed and threatened, so too are the social media companies that allowed this false narrative to catch fire on their platforms. When users on these websites make baseless, incendiary, and defamatory claims in the way Jones did, describing the murder of children as a government plot and saying families faked their own children's deaths, it can create echo chambers in comment sections or topical pages that suck in casual scrollers. Algorithms often facilitate and even boost this material. For their role in this, social media giants enjoy nearly total immunity from any liability. That protection stems from a law created in 1996 called Section 230, which safeguards websites from lawsuits targeting third-party posts. The law was drafted to help the internet grow since so much of its material is third-party content hosted on platforms. But what may have made sense then does not now. Whether the false flag conspiracy originated first on the internet and Jones amplified the vicious distortions, or the opposite occurred, the level of malice directed at these families would not be possible without Twitter and Facebook. As a society, we cannot continue to allow people to pose vile falsehoods online without repercussions for the platforms that permit those lies to fester and spread. Jones, who has now admitted the inaccuracies of his Sandy Hook claims, along with others, want to make this a free speech question. While we wholly support the fact that people's constitutionally protected right to free speech extends to online expression, the First Amendment is not a blanket protection from civil liability. Far from it. The problem at hand is the uncontrolled sprawl of false and libelous content, whether under the banner of, quote, fake news or hate speech, that has driven a wedge among people in this country, even as it has helped technology platforms ring the cash register. Free speech protections do not shield American citizens or most American companies from accountability for libel and defamation. But these protections do shield social media. Even today, after the Uvalde, Texas massacre that killed 19 children and two teachers, or the Highland Park, Illinois shooting on July 4th, where 7 people died, groups on Facebook and Twitter are spinning false flag lies, aiming to pin the responsibility elsewhere. What happened with Sandy Hook poured salt into the most devastating wound a parent could receive. But it is a byproduct of how we allow the internet to operate. The problem stretches further than Jones. Legal accountability must also be imposed on big tech. And again, this was an Other View editorial from the Dallas Morning News. Ernst switches vote to on vets healthcare bill. This comes to us from Tom Barton of the Journal Des Moines Bureau. The month of August has taken on a new meaning for Christy Castile of Marion, one marked not only by sorrow, but poetic justice. I looked up the definition, and it means fitting or deserved retribution for one's actions, and felt how true it is. True is that for every one of the soldiers there who camped out at the U.S. Capitol that have been impacted, Castile said. Facing increasing pressure from Democrats and veterans advocacy organizations, the U.S. Senate passed a bill late Tuesday expanding health care and disability benefits for millions of veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. The Senate passed the measure 86-11, with Iowa Republican U.S. Senators Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley in favor. Ernst, a combat veteran, had previously objected with some other Republicans to a budget provision in the bill, which briefly blocked its passage. Castile said explanations given for objections didn't make sense to her and seemed like a distraction. Not knowing 100% what caused them to change their minds, I just have to say I'm glad they did, she said. It's been the right thing to do from the beginning, and they've done what is right, and I'm just very happy about that. Democratic President Joe Biden has pushed for the legislation and is expected to sign the bill into law. Castile's late son, Joshua, died in August 2012 at the age of 32 of lung cancer. His family believes was caused by toxins from the burn pit at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison, where he served as an interrogator from 2004 to 2005. August is the month Joshua passed away, and it is always a month that is a difficult month, Castile said. This is something that I can be happy about. This adds a different meaning to August for me. She added her son, were he still alive, would feel the same. One of the last things he said was how we would work toward eliminating the potential of using burn pits ever again, just knowing the hazardous nature of them. And it's happened, Castile said. For that, I'm grateful. Tuesday's vote ended in a brief stalemate when the process derailed after some Senate Republicans, including Ernst, made a late attempt last week to change a budget provision in the bill and blocked it from advancing, infuriating veterans advocacy groups. A key voting block in the November midterm elections, the advocacy groups ramped up the political pressure over the last 5 days on GOP lawmakers to act. Honoring Our Pact Act first passed the Senate in June 84-14 and by a 342-88 vote in the House. But technical corrections sent the measure back to the Senate for another procedural vote on July 27th. 25 Republicans who supported the previous version of the bill, including Ernst, changed their vote over how the government accounts for spending slated for veterans programs. The bill is projected to increase federal deficits by about $277 billion over 10 years, and does not include offsetting spending cuts of tax increases. When the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office scored the bill, it projected that nearly $400 billion slated to be spent on health services would be moved from discretionary to mandatory spending. It's half past the hour and time now to turn to the obituaries. Our first obituary comes to us from Hinton, Barbara Robinson. Barbara Robinson, 75 of Hinton, passed away unexpectedly on Sunday, July 31st at her home. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday at Trinity Lutheran Church, rural Hinton, officiated by Pastor James Travis. Burial will follow at Trinity Lutheran Cemetery. Visitation with the family present will be from 5 to 7 p.m. with a prayer service at 7 p.m., all on Friday at Trinity Lutheran Church in rural Hinton. Arrangements are with Rex Winkle Funeral Home of Lamars. Expressions of sympathy may be expressed to the family through www.rexwinklefh.com. Barbara Lynn Laban was born July 25, 1947, in Sioux City to Leroy and Marjorie Mayhew Laban. She was raised in rural Hinton and attended Liberty School, later graduating from Hinton High School in 1965. Barbara was united in marriage to Fred Robinson on September 2, 1965, in North Sioux City. Barb worked at Joe Morton Insurance before staying home to raise their three children. They lived in Lamars and Hinton for a short time before moving to their farm in rural Hinton in 1974. Besides working alongside Fred at the farm, Barb also worked for JCPenney, Bollmeyer Ag, later called Sioux Nations, and Plymouth Feed. She retired in 2012. Barb was a longtime member of Trinity Lutheran Church, where she had been active in AAL and Vacation Bible School. From Sioux City, Troy Roger Benson. Troy Roger Benson, 56, died Friday, July 29th. Services will be August 5th at 10:30 a.m. at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Burial will be at a later date. From Merrill, Barbara Lee Balmer. Barbara Lee Balmer, 86, died August 1st. Celebration of life will be 2 p.m. at Mauer Johnson Funeral Home in Lamars. Burial will be following services in Hillside Cemetery, Merrill. Visitation is August 5th from 12:30 p.m. until service time at the funeral home. From Mobile, Marla J. Crichton. Marla J. Crichton, 72, died Monday, August 1st. Arrangements are pending with Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City. From Lamars, Clifford C. Frog Monroe, 89, died Tuesday, August 2nd. Celebration of life will be August 6th at 2 p.m. at Mauer Johnson Funeral Home, Lamars. Burial will be private in the Memorial Cemetery of Lamars. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. From Lamars, formerly of Ute, Lillian Cook, and that's K-O-C-H, Lillian Cook, 87, of Lamars and formerly of Ute, passed away peacefully on Wednesday, July 27th at Good Samaritan Society of Lamars following a lengthy illness. Celebration of life will be at 11 a.m. on Sunday, August 21st at the Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamars. Tom Hiller will officiate. Burial will be in St. Clair Cemetery in Ute. Visitation with the family will follow the service during a time of lunch and fellowship at the funeral home. Arrangements are with Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamars. Expressions of sympathy can be extended to the family through www.rexwinklefh.com. Lillian Rose Schweibach, the daughter of Louis and Leona Schweibach, was born on June 11, 1935, in Paulina. She attended school until the eighth grade. Then she had to go to work in order to help support her farm family financially. She was united in marriage to Wilbur Cook, again that's K-O-C-H, on June 8, 1957, and said their vows at the Little Brown Church in the Vale in Nashua, Iowa. They made their home in Ute. Lillian worked for 21 years as custodian for the Charter Oaks Ute school system and enjoyed being able to work side by side with her husband as a team. She was loved dearly by the students and staff of the school, and they could always count on Lillian to provide a safe, clean, and secure environment for the kids. There were many sad little faces the day Lillian retired. Lillian was active in the community as well. She was instrumental in setting up a new library for the town of Ute and served as president and on the board for several years. She was also vice president of the Legion Auxiliary Group. After Wilbur's passing, Lillian moved to Lamar's to be closer to family. Quickly, Lillian ingratiated herself to fellow neighbors in her senior center and in short order became the gatekeeper of facility activities. She made quite a stir when she introduced Wii, a computer bowling, to the ladies, and overnight there was born one of the most competitive bowling leagues ever witnessed for the over 70s crowd. From Sioux City, Charles Patterson. Charles Patterson died on Sunday, July 31st, at a Sioux City hospital due to a recent decline in health from advanced pancreatic and liver cancers. He passed away peacefully, surrounded by family and beautiful music. Charles has donated his body to a science program, USD. At a later date, there will be a graveside service in Sioux Falls, where he will be buried next to his wife. Condolences can be directed to Christy Smith Morningside Chapel in Sioux City. Charles was born on November 14, 1956, in Ames to Mary and Perry Patterson. He moved to Iowa City and then to Sioux Falls in 1960. His enthusiasm for nature and humanity was spawned outdoors in his early life by camping and fishing with family in Newton Hills, at swim meets in Yankton and Vermilion, on scouting trips at Leif Erickson and Camp Tipi Tanka, and at his grandparents' cabin on Lake Bemidji. His neighborhood buddies around 1503 South Spring Avenue were always up for a bike ride to anywhere, especially to explore Sherman Park and to ice skate at Campus Park. Charles graduated Washington High in 1974. He excelled in the study of biology, particularly in the study of birds of all feathers. With the U.S. Navy, he then continued his cultural journey from the sandbox of Morocco to the icebox in Iceland, honing his craft as a radio man. After graduating from Bemidji State in 1982, he met the love of his life, Julie Merdink, at a master's swim practice coached by his brother. They married in Stephen, Minnesota on December 27, 1983. While his daytime jobs included bank examiner and postal worker, his joy came from raising two children and introducing them to the outdoors. He moved to Sioux City in 2010 to help care for his parents and served as a dedicated USA swimming meet official throughout the Midwest. In lieu of gifts or cards, Charles encourages all to support world peace and the National Audubon Society. As a ham radio enthusiast, his call signal was KAOYLPSK, silent key, QSL, four piece, 73, and best wishes. From Jefferson, South Dakota, Arthur Richard Johnson. Arthur Richard Johnson, 71, of Jefferson, passed away on Monday, July 25th, at his residence. There will be a gathering at 3 p.m. on Saturday, August 27th, at Shelter Number 7 in Riverside Park. Arthur was born April 26th. This date is incorrect. The final obituary is Terry F. Coughlin of Sioux City. Terry F. Coughlin, 69, died Tuesday, August 2nd. Arrangements are pending with Nelson Berger Northside Chapel. We turn back now to the local page and read several briefs that appear in today's paper. Pilot identified in fatal plane crash near Ute. From Ute, the Monona County Sheriff's Office has identified the pilot who died in an airplane crash Saturday near Ute. The pilot, 45-year-old Brady Neil Penner of Weatherford, Oklahoma, succumbed to his injuries and was pronounced dead on the scene, according to a press release from the sheriff's office. Early information on the crash indicated that a sprayer airplane piloted by Penner struck electrical lines and crashed into the roadway near the intersection of 230th Street and Teak Avenue, south of Ute. The Monona County 911 Center was alerted to the crash shortly after 1 p.m. Saturday. County Road L37 south of Ute was closed for a time during the weekend pending a county engineer's examination of any damage done to the roadway by the plane crash. The road was reopened on Monday. It could be several months before a full report on the crash is released by the Federal Aviation Administration and the National Transportation Safety Board, which are investigating the crash, the Monona County Sheriff's Office said in its press release. Water main break leads to boil advisory from Winnebago. Residents of Winnebago are urged to boil their water before using it for drinking or cooking after a Wednesday morning water main break left the village without water. The advisory pertains to residents inside and outside of town. Bottled water disbursement will be at the Blackhawk Center back parking lot. Water will be limited to 2 cases per household. Water will be delivered to senior citizens. Portable toilets are being delivered and will be positioned at the Blackhawk Center, the police station, and other locations in town. The Winnebago Comprehensive Healthcare System will also be closed because of the lack of water. Emergency services remain available, but outpatient appointments will be rescheduled. COVID-19 testing remains available through the drive-up testing garage for those with appointments. Today's COVID vaccination clinic is postponed. Drought conditions linger in Missouri River Basin. From Sioux City, the reprieve is yet to come. On Wednesday morning, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Northwest Division announced in a release that the Missouri River Basin has seen an uptick in runoff for 2 straight months, but that the positive swing still isn't enough to get out of long-term drought conditions. July runoff in the Missouri River Basin above Sioux City, Iowa, was 3.2 million acre feet, which is 98% of average and 0.7 MAF more than was forecast last month, the release said. This has led to an annual runoff forecast of 20.6 MAF, which is 80% of average and 0.6 MAF higher than last month's forecast. Average annual runoff is 25.8 MAF. On July 6th, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced that June runoff into the basin above Sioux City was 5.2 million acre feet, 94% of average, which raised the 2022 runoff forecast to 20.0 MAF at about 1.7 MAF higher than prior month's forecast, but 78% of average. For the month of June, heavy rainfall on the upper Yellowstone River and mountain snowmelt boosted runoff to 110% of average into North Dakota Garrison Dam Reservoir. Runoff into the stretch of river between Gavin's Point Dam near Yankton and Sioux City also was 136% of average. Whiting man gets 5 years in federal prison. From Whiting, Iowa. A 42-year-old Whiting resident was sentenced Tuesday to a 5-year federal prison sentence for knowingly receiving child pornography. According to a release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa, Dason Koo received the prison term after a May 11th, 2022 guilty plea to receipt of child pornography. Koo received the material on October 24, 2018, according to the press release. In addition to a 60-month prison sentence, Koo was ordered to pay $15,000 in restitution to the victims. Once he ends his prison term, Koo has to serve 5 years of supervised release. And our final brief is headlined, Decatur Man Pleads Guilty of Sexual Abuse, from Omaha. A Decatur, Nebraska man pleaded guilty Tuesday of having sex with an underage girl on the Omaha Indian Reservation and fathering her child. Juwan Grant, 24, entered his plea in U.S. District Court in Omaha to one count of sexual abuse of a minor in Indian Country. According to court documents, Grant engaged in sexual acts with the girl, who was under age 16, in Macy in 2021 from about February through May. The girl, who gave birth in November, initially denied Grant was the father, and Grant told authority the father was probably someone who lived in Macy. During an interview at the Child Advocacy Center in Sioux City in December, the girl identified Grant as the father of her child and said he also provided her with methamphetamine and marijuana on several occasions. DNA tests have determined Grant is the child's father. We turn now to the sports page and our local baseball roundup. Mobile Futures loses regional opener. This comes to us from Rapid City, South Dakota. The Mobile Futures of the Wynn Sparks American Legion Post 303 baseball team lost to the Millard, Nebraska team on Wednesday at the Central Plains Region Tournament. Millard started off to a 6-0 lead in the first 2.5 innings. The Futures scored their first on an RBI groundout from Caleb Blyle, which scored Damon Schmidt. Schmidt led off that inning with a triple to left field on a 2-0 count. Then in the sixth inning, Spencer's Carson Jaeger had a one-out double down the right field line. Carter Bleel scored on that play. The Woodbury Central athlete led off the inning with a single. The Futures had 5 hits and Jaeger had 2 of them. Both of his hits were doubles. East senior Aiden Hawkap took the loss. He went 2 1/3 innings, allowing 3 earned runs, 6 total, on 7 hits. He struck out 1 and did not surrender a walk. The McGill brothers, Eric and Max, pitched the rest of the game in relief. They combined to allow 4 earned runs on 4 hits, both combined for 8 walks. Late Tuesday, the Red Hawks topped the Explorers 11-10. The Sioux City Explorers put together a 7-run, 2-out rally in the 5th, but it wasn't enough as the Fargo-Moorhead Redhawks walked it off in the 9th to win the ballgame 11-10. After Fargo held a 2-0 lead throughout the first 2 innings, the Exes got on the board with Trey Martin's 8th home run of the year. His solo blast set a new career high and made it 2-1. Fargo went on a 2-out rally in the bottom of the 4th. A walk and a single led Manuel Boskin driving in 2 with a double and then scoring on Leo Pena's double to give the Redhawks a 5-1 lead. But it was the Exes who would have the more impressive 2-out rally. After a flyout and a groundout, Zach Cohn innocently began a torrid stretch for the Explorer hitting with a ground ball single into center. From there, the next 8 consecutive batters reached on a hit. Blake Tiberi drove in a run to make it 5-2. Martin doubled to pull Sioux City to within a run and then scored the tying run on a Danry Vasquez single. Gabe Snyder gave the Exes the lead with a base hit. Nate Sampson added to the lead with a double, handing the Exes an 8-5 lead. Sampson's double was the 104th of his Sioux City career, tying him for the Explorers' all-time franchise lead with Nolan Lane. That finished the night for Fargo starter Tyler Grauer, who received a no decision, allowing the 8 runs on 12 hits over 5 innings with 3 strikeouts and no walks. Fargo stormed back in the next couple of innings. Ben Liversey smacked in the first home run of his professional career. The 2-run shot pulled the Hawks to within 1. That spelled the end of the night for the Sioux City starter Tom Wendell. He also received a no decision as he allowed 7 runs, 6 earned on 7 hits, through 4 innings with 5 walks and 3 strikeouts. In the 6th, Reimer Liriano put the Red Hawks in front with a 3-run homer to left, giving them a 10-8 advantage. Sioux City battled back with a run in the 7th on a Gabe Snyder solo homer, and in the 8th on a Tiberi single to score Danny Amaral after his 4th hit of the game. Sioux City tied a season high with 17 hits in the contest. After both stranded the go-ahead runs at 3rd in their respective 8th innings, and Sioux City couldn't get anything started in the top of the 9th, it was Sam Dexter who led off the bottom of the 9th with a single to left that was compounded with a throwing error that allowed him to reach 2nd. After a pop-out and a walk, Peter Maris smacked his 4th hit of the game, a double off the right center field wall, to score Dexter and walk it off for Fargo 11-10. And this brings us to the end of reading the Sioux City Journal for today, Thursday, August 4th, 2022. If you have any questions or comments for Iris, please call us on our toll-free line 1-877-404-4747. Thank you for listening to your Sioux City Journal.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.